I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Mick Mounts, the founder of Kiva Systems, a mobile robotics company that automates the warehouse fulfillment process. Kiva robots deliver inventory shelves to stationary human operators who then pick and pack the product and send it off for shipping. Mick started Kiva Systems in 2003, and the company was acquired by Amazon for $775 million in spring 2012. Customers include Diapers.com and Zappos, both owned by Amazon, Saks Fifth Avenue, Staples, Toys R Us, and The Gap, among others. Prior to founding Kiva, Mick worked in high-tech product development at Motorola, Apple, and the online grocery company Webvan. Mick is a graduate of MIT and Harvard Business School. Welcome.
Thank you. It's fun to be here.
I want to start by understanding the traditional warehouse. Could you describe briefly the day in the life of a warehouse worker?
Yeah, the traditional warehousing, at least what I was experiencing in the late 90s, was characterized by a lot of conveyors and forklifts and other static, stationary shelving devices. Classically, a pick worker would grab a tote or a cart or some some RF picking device that might be mounted to their wrist, and they would follow the instructions and walk from location to location in the warehouse to find those items. And sometimes they pick an order at a time or multiple orders at a time, but they're going out to gather the inventory, bring it back to somebody else who's then going to do the pack out. And when we started Kiva, we turned that whole equation on its head and said, what if all of the inventory in the warehouse could walk and talk on its own and just come to you, the pick-pack worker?
A typical pick worker can walk 5 to 10 miles a day and spend, 70% of their time walking around the warehouse. I've heard you say before that regarding the experience of a worker, not only is this an unproductive way to fill orders, it's also an unfulfilling way to fill orders.
Yeah, it can be a kind of a rough job, and we're talking about direct labor in the factory setting that's probably being paid on the order of $10, $12, $14 an hour. And it's interesting for a while, but then it becomes pretty routine pretty quickly. Part of the unfulfilling part, at least, is that a lot of the technologies and existing processes don't allow you to do your job well. So you get to a location and you're supposed to get a red T-shirt and you're out of red T-shirts. And so then you end up spending all this extra time looking for where did they put the extra red T-shirts. And obviously we tried to change that whole equation with our approach.
With Kiva Systems, instead of the workers going to get the inventory comes to them. Can you describe that process briefly?
Sure. So instead of walking out to a location to get the T-shirts, we send mobile robots that travel on the ground out to get underneath a mobile shelving pod. It's an inventory pod that contains lots of different items. We pick it up just an inch or two off the ground, and then we drive that shelving unit all the way over to where the pick worker is standing. And then they present themselves in a serial fashion in front of the pick worker so that every 6 seconds they can reach out their hand and pick another item of inventory. It allows the pick worker access to every single item of the inventory without moving their feet.
How fast do these robots move around the warehouse? What's the mile per hour?
It's interesting. It's super slow. What we did is model the robots after the speed that humans would be walking, say, for example, in a grocery store, about 3 feet per second. And so when you see a bunch of them in the building, they're all kind of moving at a walking pace, yet they're getting a lot of work done very quickly because the human operator experiences a continuous pick face in front of them.
The warehouses look like a mini city on a grid system. It's like traffic, like cars moving around. How much did maps and the idea of automobile traffic play into your vision of what the warehouses would look like?
The way we approach it is less about like highway traffic and more about just a reservation-based system. So as they drive, they're reserving small stickers in this grid system, and as they get to the next sticker, they release the last sticker. Our software control system is probably more better described as an air traffic control system, which is deciding who gets to go when, where, and why. And then that creates this fluid set of motion amongst all of the robots.
Where does the name Kiva come from?
It is a Hopi Indian word that means meeting place of the ant people, or loosely ant colony. And so we use the term Kiva because our original logo was an ant carrying a package. It was kind of like the ant colony at your picnic that carries off all of your food.
Also, ants are complex organisms who are very strong. I think an ant can carry multiple times its weight.
True. I hadn't thought about the individual ant strength analogy until you pointed it out. But yeah, our robots weigh about 250 pounds, and they carry a 1,000-pound payload around of shelving. But the real metaphor that I like is at the systems level, an ant colony is a very robust organism, and it's really hard to kill. Mm. Once you get ants in your kitchen, really hard to get rid of them. So we are similar. Our approach to solving this warehouse inventory picking problem is to use hundreds and thousands, if not thousands, of robots in a building, all with a little bit of information, but collectively very capable of getting the work done and very robust.
One of the things that Kiva Systems does is track the popularity of a product. So let's say it's Valentine's Day. There'll be more pink candies being procured or fulfilled than Christmas time. So the robots are able to, the shelves are able to be moved to farther away from the human operators than those products that are more popular.
That's right. One of the side effects of making everything mobile in the warehouse is that you can now dynamically and adaptively tune the layout of the warehouse. And so as more chalky pink candy is being ordered, all of that stuff kind of moves to the front of the warehouse. But the day after Valentine's Day, as nobody's ordering that stuff, it starts to drift to the back of the warehouse and get out of the way. And traditional warehouses would have tackled that problem by bringing a crew of humans in over the weekend to reslot the warehouse and move all that stuff around. And in our system, it just happens automatically.
I'd like to talk about the cost of the robots. A startup kit for these robots is, you know, $1 to $2 million. And if you have a warehouse of, let's say, 1,000 robots, that's, you know, close to $20 million. And it takes you, you know, 6 months to plan and set up the grid system. How did you justify the cost to potential customers in the early days?
There's a pretty well-known kind of trade-off, which we call the 2-year CapEx versus OpEx trade-off. I'll gladly spend $1 million if I'm going to save $500,000 a year for the next 2 years. Mm. And if you can hit that 2-year CapEx-OpEx trade-off, the automation projects tend to get approved pretty quickly. And in our case, to bring this disruptive solution to market, we had to do a lot of innovation around the business itself. We had to approach our potential clients with a brand new pricing model that took the risk out of the equation for them. So when they were thinking about converting from a conveyor-based system to a Kiva, we knew it would work, but they weren't quite so comfortable. So we'd say, look, if we get all the way to the end and you still don't like it, you can send it back.
You mentioned disruption. Kiva is a disruptive technology. It's not just a bunch of robots delivering products in a traditional warehouse. You really have changed the paradigm of the warehouse. What other companies do you look to who have been equally disruptive in their own industries?
There's a lot. Along the way, we used to think about who else has dealt with similar disruptive challenges when they grew their business. And companies like Southwest Airlines would come to mind. People always laugh about low-cost Southwest Airlines, but yet it's the only profitable airline over an extended 10 to 15-year period. And how do they do that? Well, they just take a very robust and simple approach. They use one aircraft, a 737, for all their flights. They originally had an open seating policy, so people really would hustle to get in and get their seats. And they took a very fun approach to flying, too. Another one we always used to talk about was FedEx. Today, you think about the ability to overnight a package from almost anywhere in the world next day. And that capability didn't exist, you know, 20 or I guess it was about 30 years ago.
Yeah.
It was unheard of.
We were talking about convincing customers to adopt Kiva. And your first customer was Staples. How did that happen?
The introduction, so we identified Staples as a likely consumer of the Kiva solution, and we had emailed into just about everybody we knew from every angle over there without much success. But when we were out seeking venture funding, the team at Bain Capital actually was able to introduce us to Staples.
Bain Capital was your investor, but they weren't among the early investors whom you approached. You got about 100 no's before you finally met them. What was the appetite among venture capitalists when you were presenting this idea?
The first few years would have been 2002 and 2003. I was still living in Palo Alto in the Bay Area. And so naturally, I was traveling Sand Hill Road, meeting with a lot of venture teams out there. And, it wasn't a great time for raising money. They were still licking their wounds from the dot-com crash of 2001. And we were a hardware play. And so at this point, they were looking for the next software company or some internet-type play that could grow quickly on unlimited amount of capital. And so, yes, to your point, we had the door closed in our face quite a bit. And they used to say things like, you're going to need $100 million to get this thing to cash flow break even. And then some. So I became convinced, actually, in those early years that maybe venture capital was not the right funding model for Kiva, this capital-intensive business. So I end up working my network, friends of friends, to find some investors that got it and that wanted to take a risk. I managed to meet up with a gentleman named Sam Kinney, who was one of the co-founders of Free Markets, which was a 1999 very successful internet startup. Anyway, I met up with him. He introduced me to additional co-founders and early employees of Free Markets, and we started to put together kind of a $1.6 million Series A round to get the company to do a proof of concept.
How firm was your conviction that you thought this was viable and this would work, especially in the face of multiple no's?
I knew that it could work, but, you know, as a first-time entrepreneur, CEO, all that stuff, I probably didn't appreciate all of the challenges that were going to be involved in building the company. But you have that kind of that naivete that actually makes you think you can do it, which is useful, very useful, actually.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Mick Mounts, founder of Kiva Systems. We'll hear more from Mick Mounts coming up. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Mick Mounts, the founder of Kiva Systems, a mobile robotics company that automates the warehouse fulfillment process. Kiva robots deliver inventory shelves to stationary human operators who then pick and pack the product and send it off for shipping. Mick started Kiva Systems in 2003, and the company was acquired by Amazon for $775 million in spring 2012. Customers include Diapers.com and Zappos, both owned by Amazon, Saks Fifth Avenue, Staples, Toys R Us, and The Gap, among others. So I want to talk some more about the early days of the company. You were sleeping on friends' couches, and what was your burn rate personally?
Burn rate on me physically or burn rate cash-wise, the checkbook, all of that?
You tell me.
So the reason I was sleeping on people's couches is because I was keeping the burn rate near zero. I remember in that year, I think it was in 2003, something like 300 days on the road that year, 299 on other people's beds or couches, and one night in a Red Roof Inn because I just couldn't drive any further and had to pull over. And it said $29.99 for the night.
What was your social life at the time with such a nomadic existence?
I was single. Dating at the time, so I didn't have a lot that tied me down or restricted me from kind of taking this leap with both feet.
We talked before about Staples being your first customer. how important was that in being a catalyst for other retailers to come on board?
Yeah, so Staples is a very interesting story. We had identified a list of about 25 customers that we just thought, if all of these customers are using Kiva, then we've arrived. And Staples was on that list. And we were pleasantly surprised at the conversation when they came by. Only kind of in the ensuing year did we put together the reasons why they acted so quickly. But they were in a hyper-competitive space, just office supplies, and it was them against Office Depot, against Office Max, against Corporate Express. All of these guys are effectively selling the same 3M yellow Post-it notes and red pens. And so how do you differentiate in that environment? Well, it's through your pick, pack, and ship fulfillment capability. And so Staples saw our stuff and thought, geez, if this works, we probably ought to know about it. And wouldn't it be great if Office Depot didn't know about it? And so in that competitive context, they moved very quickly to try it. And then we quickly followed with Walgreens, later with Zappos and Gap and some others. And I think there was a critical mass building. You could see some of the leading online retailers using our stuff. And so that became kind of a self-fulfilling thing where most people who wanted to solve this problem would come and talk to us because we had a lot of the key accounts.
There were other people who started Kiva with you, including Pete Warman and Raffaello D'Andrea. How do you know them?
So Pete Warman is my roommate from MIT. He was teaching computer science and as it related to e-commerce, and he knew exactly how to make this thing work from a software standpoint. And I met Raf through another friend of ours, Mary Lane Vandermeulen, who was sitting across the hall from him at Cornell as a professor. I showed him what we wanted to do with these robots, and this built on everything that he had been doing in his academic career with controlling complex systems. He's a controls expert that can make these systems operate robustly.
One example of a robot that he built is a soccer robot.
That's right. You'd put five autonomous robots on a little mini soccer field against some other university, and the 10 robots would go at it autonomously. And his RoboCup teams at Cornell were winning every year. And when I showed Raf what we were working on, it was almost like falling off a log compared to playing soccer. We had a controlled environment. We could put down a grid. Nobody can go in there. There's no opponent that you have to outguess. You just have to control these things. So he signed up pretty quickly.
You mentioned that one of your co-founders was your roommate at MIT. You've had a couple of other friends join the company and also family members. Your father worked at the company. What was his role?
That's right. So I would talk to my dad about every other weekend, and I could tell he was getting more and more interested and getting kind of sucked into the process. And one day I just said, hey, why don't you just stop what you're doing and just move out. He was in Phoenix at the time. Move out to Boston and work on this. It'd be much more fun. You can do it full time. I don't have to call you every Sunday. So he took me up on it and came out, worked in our supply chain group using his logistics background.
You have one sister who's a helicopter pilot for the military, but you have another, your older sister has joined Kiva.
She was a part-time assistant in our HR team for a number of years. And my brother-in-law, her husband, had a PhD in robot path planning. Go figure. So he and my sister Cindy and family moved from the Chicago area to Boston. She was the sole person in our HR department almost up until like employee number 100, all part-time.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Mick Mounts, founder of Kiva Systems, a mobile robotics fulfillment company. Customers include Crate and Barrel, Timberland, The Gap, and Staples. Kiva Systems was acquired by Amazon in spring 2012 for $775 million. Incidentally, in 2008, you were watching the Beijing Olympics, and you've mentioned that the opening ceremony was in some way a parallel to what you were doing at Kiva. How is that?
Right. So in 2008, my wife and I are watching the Beijing opening ceremonies on TV, and they show 2,000 people on the stadium floor making art. And I said to my wife, hey, that was the idea for Kiva. Just put lots and lots of people on the warehouse floor, and they can do some very interesting collaborative things. Of course, we didn't end up using people. We used robots to do it. But I was fascinated by the opening ceremonies there because they were able to make some incredible artwork, and I was told it was all done without computers, but just peer-to-peer with them working it out amongst themselves and coordinating.
I want to go back to when you hatched the idea for Kiva. You had been working at Webvan, which is the online grocery delivery company that raised hundreds of millions of dollars of venture capital and went bankrupt, perhaps because they were too early for their time and they didn't have this logistics framework baked into it. Could you describe how you came up with the idea briefly?
Sure. I mean, my experience at Webvan was the genesis. That's where I was able to experience at least the problem firsthand. That company was taking online grocery orders, much like a Peapod or in New York City, a Fresh Direct. And what would happen is the cost of fulfilling the order, delivering the order, and having the customer support relationship, those total costs would completely overwhelm the margin on that grocery order. And so clearly, part of the reason the company went out of business was it was losing money on every order. And my job at Webvan was to think about next-generation fulfillment solutions. The internet was new. E-commerce was new. There hadn't been much kind of clean thinking around what does it mean to get one green T-shirt, one toothpaste, one can of soup in a tote, a box, or a bag. So this notion of each-based picking I felt was unsolved, and I racked my brain for a year over there trying to think about how to do this. The existing solutions just didn't stack up, and about a year and a half later, it was still bugging me, and that's how that's when I really got started on the problem.
We talked about Webvan's influence on Kiva's development, but you also worked at Apple starting in 1996. You were at Apple for about 3 years, and you were helping to move technology onto their desktop platform. This is also when Steve Jobs returned to Apple. Similar to Apple, at Kiva, you really control every step of the product chain, of the design, the aesthetic, the software, the robot operators, the stickers, everything from cradle to grave. And that's somewhat reflective of what Apple did. Can you explain that?
For sure.
That linkage?
That's right. So we're bringing a very complex solution to market, and we're going to put this in a customer's warehouse. So it just has to work. And so we decided to take the same approach that Apple did when they would develop a technology like the original iPod, for example. The reason it was in some sense so successful is Apple not only made the iPod, but they were involved in the USB interface to the Mac. They made the logic board for the Mac. They made the operating system that ran on the logic board, and they made the iTunes software that connected to the iPod. So rather than having to think through and deal with all those technologies, the consumer was able to just listen to music.
What are some of your memories of Steve Jobs? Like, are there any, random stories that come to mind from those days?
You learn a lot through osmosis when you see somebody like that. And I kind of had a front row seat for the turnaround. And when he got back in 97, the company was working on all kinds of different projects. And one of the things I remember was that meeting where he rolled out the new 2x2. We make desktops and portables, and we make consumer and professional. And if you're not in one of those four boxes, you can leave. Everything else is going to be shuttered. And luckily, I was in the desktop professional box. Mm-hmm. And then he said in that same meeting, so which one of these are we? We have this product, what are we missing? We're missing the consumer desktop. And so he had already developed the thesis and was working on his iMac vision. What I also remember about those days at Apple was everything became even more secret and super secret. And so I would, the guy in the product marketing manager in the office next to me would be working on the iMac and couldn't tell me anything about it, whereas only, a year earlier we were all working on these projects together and sharing experiences.
How did you feel about that level of secrecy within the same company?
It was different, but it was completely understood that, if your customer knows that the next version of the product is coming out, they're not going to buy the current version. So it was understood why.
Any other anecdotes, impressions of him?
Well, when I was working there, I used to tell my friends in the Bay Area, it's very interesting because he's so smart and his, his passion and vision for the industry is really compelling, but I think he succeeds despite himself. And that, with just small changes to the way he treats people or leads, he could be even more effective.
You founded Kiva Systems in 2003 and were acquired by Amazon in 2012. How did that acquisition happen? Did they approach you? Were they a customer of yours to begin with?
Amazon directly was not a customer of Kiva. In fact, that was the number one question that we would get from other clients or prospective investors was, hey, why isn't Amazon using this? But in our sales efforts, we would make the kind of annual trip out to Seattle to try to convince Amazon that they ought to use a Kiva system in one of their warehouses for pick, pack, and ship. And in 2012, the conversation got more interesting as they said, okay, but if we're going to do that, we'd like to own the whole company.
Did you think that maybe they would try to build it themselves in-house?
That's always a real possibility, but I wasn't too worried about that because we'd been at it for, say, 8 or 9 years at that point.
Yeah.
And we developed a ginormous portfolio of patents, and we've solved a lot of hard problems. So even patents aside, some of the things we figured out how to do are very hard to learn. And so given that technology challenge, we weren't too worried about other people copying it.
At the time Amazon acquired you, you had been fulfilling orders for Diapers.com and Zappos, who were owned by Amazon. So perhaps that helped.
It did help. We think it helped. So for a moment there, we thought about changing our marketing tagline to say, buy Akiva, get bought by Amazon. Mm. We didn't end up doing that because then, of course, it happened to us.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Mick Mounts, the founder of Kiva Systems, a mobile robotics company that automates the warehouse fulfillment process. I want to talk about your childhood. Where did you grow up?
So I was born in Frankfurt, Germany, in a U.S. Army hospital. My dad was in the military, so we had that classic Army brat upbringing where we were moving every couple of years somewhere new. I think I had 9 different schools by the time I finished high school or 12th grade.
What kind of child were you? What kind of kid were you?
I guess the funniest thing I can think about my childhood was when I was an adult already in my 20s, I took the Myers-Briggs test, and it comes out ENTJ.
What does that mean?
No, ENTP. So ENTJ is this classic leader profile where people who run companies, but I'm not that. I'm ENTP, which the tagline for that personality type was called One Exciting Challenge After Another. And I was showing it to my folks, said, supposedly this is my personality, and they started reading it, and they burst out laughing at the paragraph where it said, as a child, the ENTP, when asked to take out the trash, will spend the next 2 days trying to invent a system for the trash to take out itself rather than just doing the chore. And so they're like, that's you. That's absolutely you.
And along those lines, you tried to create, when you were, 11 years old, an automated process for doing your homework rather than you doing it yourself?
Yeah, my mom later, when I was running Kiva, sent me some old little clippings from the scrapbook kind of stuff that said, it was an essay, what do you want to invent? And I wanted to invent a machine that would do all my homework. And I feel like that was actually what I ended up working on at Apple, was my homework machine, the Mac.
Your parents were in the military. How were they as parents? Were they militaristic or?
Probably quite the opposite. They just gave us a ton of support for whatever it was that we were interested in. So, my father and my mother were role models and influential, inspirational in different ways. So my dad was the kind of hard work ethic, always had to be doing something productive. And then he also taught me sports, right? So he was a college football player at the University of Illinois, and I developed a love of sports by hanging out with him. And then my mother had a scientific curiosity, so she would take me, for example, into the laundry room at age 7 and turn out the lights to say, watch this, and open the dryer drawer and dryer door, and all the clothes would spark as she was pulling them out.
Mm.
And so there was a lot of little memories like that that contributed, I think, to both my competitive kind of my competitive nature through playing sports and working hard, and then my scientific curiosity that my mother kind of instilled.
You used to exercise a lot before you started Kiva and having kids.
That's right.
Now you have no time. You did yoga. You played baseball at MIT for 4 years. You ran triathlons.
Yeah, it kind of goes away when you have a startup and you're doing 80 to 100 hours a week. But so I was fortunate in that my early few years at Kiva, with my schedule, I could really get in great shape. And I was in great shape when I started the company. And, of course, now with three little ones at home, my priority is to try to get some time with them in the morning and in the evening before they get to bed.
I've been told that you drink a lot of coffee. Just how much are we talking about?
Well, so the coffee, the caffeine is a mental stimulus for me. I actually did an experiment 1 year where I tried to go a whole year without caffeine and without alcohol. And it turns out I ended up going a year and a half without alcohol. Didn't miss it, didn't need it. But the caffeine, for after 4 months, I could barely complete a sentence. And so I had to start drinking coffee again. So I'll have a couple of cups of coffee in the morning, kind of the perpetual cup, and then switch to maybe one or two Mountain Dews in the afternoon.
Mountain Dew because?
The caffeine.
Mm.
And the sugar, I guess. By then I need the sugar, too.
And you like Lucky Charms cereal?
Yeah, there was a period there when we were getting the company going that I felt that not only Lucky Charms was a nutritious breakfast, but that it was having some impact on our ability to win new deals.
Well, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks. It was a pleasure to be here.
My guest has been Mick Mounts, the co-founder of Kiva. Coming up, we'll meet Alexa Hirschfeld, co-founder of Paperless Post. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Alexa Hirschfeld, co-founder of Paperless Post, a web-based company that sends digital invitations. Users can choose all the design elements of a card, ranging from font to color, pattern, size, and Paperless Post has delivered more than 60 million invitations and cards since its inception in 2009. Alexa started the company when she was 23 years old with her younger brother, James. Welcome.
Thank you.
How would you describe what Paperless Post is?
Paperless Post is a website that you go to and you can design anything that you'd buy in a brick-and-mortar stationery store, except that you send it all online. Once you've designed it, you put in your recipients' names and email addresses. When you send it to them, they receive it in their inbox and you can track their RSVPs. And I think the key difference between us and other online invitation companies is that it really looks like what you'd buy in a brick-and-mortar stationery store, from the texture of the paper stock that the invitation appears to be printed on to the envelope with the receiver's name on it that shows up in their inbox and the animation for the more formal cards.
You co-founded the company with your brother, James. How did the idea for the company originate?
It was the result of a series of conversations that James and I had about various things that we wanted to do together. In the beginning, it was that we wanted to work together on a movie, on a film, so he would be the director and I would be the writer and producer. And then I had an idea for another company where it also involved the internet and a mass customization tool where people would design their own suits and they would get made in Vietnam and in Hoi An and then get sent to the U.S., Neither one of those panned out, but we kept talking, and James called me one day and had this idea. He said, you know, I think that if this were available, people would use it, and I think that they'd probably pay for it, too. I remember responding and saying, I think that you're right that people would use it. I don't know whether they'd pay for it, but I think that we should do it.
Your brother was at Harvard, where you also had graduated from. Do you know how he came up with this idea at the time?
He was actually planning a birthday party for himself. It was his 21st birthday. He'd ordered palm trees, little mini palm trees for $5 each, and printed cups that said Beach Club. You know, it was in the middle of winter, but it said Beach Club on them. But then when it came around to actually inviting people to the party, he really didn't have very many options because it was 2 weeks or 3 weeks away, and he didn't have people's home addresses, and he didn't really have enough money to spend on printing invitations. But at the same time, he didn't want to use Evite or email, which wouldn't express how cool he knew the party would be. So it was actually out of his own experience that he came up with the idea of paperless post.
What were you doing at the time that also was leading you in the direction of wanting to start an online business?
There are a lot of other thoughts that went into doing this kind of company. One of them is that I was working at an older media company, and I was noticing the difficulties that they were having monetizing their content online. It seemed like a really, really big, scary thing for a lot of people and an opportunity for young people who were looking for an opportunity to be creative and solve a problem that the world needed.
You mentioned you had been working for a traditional older media company. That's CBS. You were Katie Kirk's assistant.
Yes.
How did you get that job?
I had worked with her at the Olympics in Athens in 2004. And the reason I got that job was because I speak Greek and read and write Greek because my mom's family is Greek American. So it was all very roundabout how I ended up there.
And when you were at CBS, you did receive a lot of invitations in the mail. Did that influence your thinking that, you know what, maybe this could work?
We did receive a lot of invitations at CBS for Katie. But one of the interesting things was that if people were trying to follow up, they would always do it by email. So it meant that essentially for any invitation, there also had to be a digital version. So all of a sudden, it seemed as though the print version was sort of a formality.
Your brother was very specific about his idea, and he is somewhat of an artist. What is his background in the artistic area?
He's entirely self-taught in terms of visual design and graphic design. His entire life, he's been practicing art. So he was a photographer, he was a painter, coin collector, stamp collector, sculptor. And I remember seeing other people's reaction to the things that he would make. And it would be things that he would make in his room. But I remember seeing my mother's friends at our house and always having the same kind of reaction, being impressed.
Mm-hmm.
And that was something that I also thought about when he was telling me about this idea.
Your mom is from Greece.
From Greece via Pennsylvania.
Okay. And how about your father?
My father's from New York City.
What did your parents do? What do your parents do?
My parents are both lawyers. Mm. And my dad now practices real estate. And my mom is actually a in-house counsel at Paperless Post.
You mentioned that your mom is Greek and that you speak Greek. Do you speak any other languages?
Yeah, languages were the thing that I was that made me most interested in school initially. So I speak and read and write modern Greek, and I speak Spanish, and I also know Latin and ancient Greek as well from school.
How do you think that's informed any of this?
I think it's informed a lot of it because I am really interested in the programming languages that we use, and I've learned enough about each of them to understand what I need to know about how they're used, and that makes my job really fun.
When you say programming languages, you're talking about computer programming languages, the plumbing that goes on behind what you see.
That's right. It's what makes it all work.
Because ultimately, it seems like, as well as being a design-oriented company, Paperless Post is a technology company.
Yeah, and more of that, half the people that work at Paperless Post are software developers.
You were 23 years old when you launched the company, and your brother was 21. How did that help or hurt?
So somebody told us once that one of the things you learn when you start a company is that everything that you think is going to be easy is really hard and takes a really long time. And everything that you think is going to be hard is really hard and takes a really long time. And one of the benefits to being a really young person with very little experience when you start a company is that you really do not have much fear about what's going to go into it. And you have the energy to stay up all night, and you have the fearlessness to write somebody that's more senior than you and ask them to work at your company.
Who was one of the people you wrote letters to, senior executives?
I think it wasn't as much senior executives. Mm-hmm. It was more people that knew things that we didn't know, like very, very good software developers. There's a very important technical culture at our company, and that was really founded and cultivated by Aaron Quint, who is our CTO. And in the beginning, he contracted with Paperless Post, and he really wasn't going to come on and work full-time because he had a really great career contracting. And so hiring people that were really different from us and not being scared to ask them to come work with us, and the fact that we were all young, he's also my age, was definitely a benefit in terms of building the company.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Alexa Hirschfeld, co-founder of Paperless Post, a web-based company that enables users to email custom-made stationery that wouldn't typically be sent over the internet. Users range from individuals to institutions like the Metropolitan Museum of Art or the National Gallery. So you had this moment where you thought, okay, we're gonna give this a try. Your brother was still in college, and you were still working as Katie Couric's assistant. What happened then?
What happened was that it was a process of working backwards from the end product that James had defined, the unit of which was a card that was customized. We worked backwards to understand how you would have that be sent over the internet. We quickly realized that it would be via a design process that a user would be in control of, which meant that we needed to create a tool online that would enable a user to create that end product. On nights and weekends, we would meet with a lot of different people, and we would also spend a lot of alone time in our parents' house, or when he was at school and I was living at my parents' house, laying out and designing what we could do. And for him, that was the card and the cards and the format of the end product. And for me, it was the user interface that would enable users to design those cards.
How did you raise capital in the early days? And how much capital did you need early on if it was just you and your brother?
We didn't raise capital until we launched in 2009. We were able to raise capital because we had traction, because we had users, not because we were telling a story about a future when we would have a product and have users.
Once you launched the site, what were the first invitations you sent out, and how did you get traction initially?
Well, we never sent out invitations. So what happened was that there were people that knew what we were doing and asked us when they could use it. And so I had said to a friend that she could use it by September 30th, and she kept bugging me about using it. She kept bugging me, and finally I gave her a password, and I didn't think she'd be able to use the product or navigate through it. And then she gave me a call a few hours later, and she said, "So did you see what I made?" And I said, "No, I didn't see what you made." And she said, well, can you just go on the site and log on and look at this invitation? Do you like the font color I chose? Do you like the font I chose? Do you like this? I thought it was really great that I chose that champagne bottle." And so she ended up sending that invitation to, 200 or 220 people. And honestly, there is no other way to describe how people started using Paperless Post other than that party.
What was the party for?
For her 22nd birthday.
One of your board members is Ram Shriram, who was an early investor in Google. How did you meet him?
We actually didn't meet Ram personally. He received an invitation or multiple invitations, and so he ended up going to the homepage of Paperless Post and reading about the About Us, and then maybe doing a little more Googling about us, and then wrote us a really warm email to our help email, we wrote him back and we ended up having breakfast with him in New York City.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Alexa Hirschfeld, co-founder of Paperless Post, a web-based company that sends digital stationery. Paperless Post makes money by selling virtual coins for customizing its cards, and the company became profitable in 2010. Your chief operating officer, Lucy Grayson, helped you define the strategy and the business model for the company. How exactly was she helpful, and how do you make money?
I'd say she's been extremely helpful because she came in and helped us define who we were as a business, not just as a product. By her asking, we had to think really hard about how were we going to make money, and a lot of the options didn't fit with the product we'd created because having ads would have meant interjecting between two people's communication. My brother made the comment in a New York Times article that you would never have a flyer in a wedding invitation, so why would you have an ad on an online wedding invitation? And by April of 2009, we deployed a direct-to-consumer payment model. So I credit Lucy's involvement greatly with our self-definition as a business.
What were some stumbling blocks for you in the early days? You were fortunate in that you had a clear concept for the company and that you got traction pretty immediately. What was harder for you than you thought?
Every business that you create, there's also a lot of things that happen behind the scenes. We did learn along the way that there were a lot of other things a business required to succeed, such as email deliverability, which is one of the most detail-oriented and difficult sets of rules to learn, but James somehow became our in-house email deliverability expert
guru.
I remember Lucy saying early on when James was on a call about email deliverability, she was like, "Thank you for caring so much." And it was true. It's just out of pure care to learn something like email deliverability, and a lot of things that are not pretty go into creating an actual company.
Paperless Post offers a platform for design partners, ranging from large companies like Crane and Boltman Geller to boutique stationers. But it wasn't always that way. You didn't always have these outsourcing design partners. What were some of the first designs that you and your brother came up with?
One of the first ones was called Saint-Germain, and it was a cream rectangular invitation that had a gold bevel and rounded corners, and it just had a simple script font, and it was extremely formal and actually probably not financially viable to send with paper, but that and a few other invitations, one had a silk black ribbon, and it was sort of a shimmery silver paper stock. That was also very popular. Basically, we started out with this line that was extremely formal, and the interesting thing was that when users saw Paperless Post in the beginning, they just felt that that meant that they could use us for formal things, so they started using us for things like, you know, engagement parties or rehearsal dinners and later on actual weddings. And that wasn't really a core part of our plan, but it was amazing that that happened as a result of the type of cards that we originally started with.
You mentioned, you know, silk shimmery paper stock and liners. Now, we have to remember this is all virtual. What are some other designs you came up with?
One of the famous cards that we started out with was red, and it had black and white zebras jumping across the border, and it was based off of a wallpaper in an Italian restaurant in Midtown called Gino's, which I think is sadly now closed.
On Lexington Avenue in New York City. Paperless Post is effectively making stationery more affordable using a digital medium. For instance, you have a calligrapher named Bernard Meisner, who in the real world, his artwork and his actual cards are very expensive.
Bernard Meisner is one of the best calligraphers in the world. One of the wonderful things about having these design partners was that we could have people like Bernard Meisner, whose cards are normally at the mid-range, $6 per item, allow that type of design to be accessed by people who would not otherwise be able to afford to use it. And basically the reason for that is that we are only offering the design itself and the visual quality and not the cost of producing it in physical form.
You mentioned $6 per item. Do you mean per letter?
Yes.
Who is another artist, designer, that's offered on the site whom you particularly like?
Mr. Boddington is a line that is on Paperless Post. It's a sub-brand of Mr. Boddington, which is an offline artisanal stationer in New York City. The sub-brand is Mr. Boddington's Nephew, and it's been incredibly popular.
What does it look like?
It is colorful. It's witty. There's often hand-driven fonts on the cards, and it has its own very distinctive brand. There are colors that are regularly used, like pink and yellow and orange, and you know that it's Mr. Boddington when you see it. It's a really great sort of auger for the future of these design partnerships that we have, because we're actually being able to share a lot of revenue with these really talented designers and offer them a platform to get exposure to lots of visitors.
What was the last invitation you sent?
The last invitation I sent was a Chinese New Year invitation. It was for a dinner party that I'm having tonight. And it was on a card that looks like a gold coin, and it flips, and then there is sort of a witty joke, and then an invitation to dinner at 9.
Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
My guest has been Alexa Hirschfeld, co-founder of Paperless Post. If you'd like to learn more about the show, please visit our website at fromscratchradio.com or follow us on Twitter at Jess G. Harris or find us on Facebook. Our website is fromscratchradio.org. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch.